Chris, Dom, Dina, what's going on?
What's up? How's it going?
So we have the Thule Young Brothers and Dina Hagog from Chicago, U.S. artists. USA artists?
U.S.
United
artists.
States. United States artists. Basically just a bunch of friends hanging out. And thanks for coming in the rain.
Of course.
Thanks for thanks for spending the last hour of your Friday, or maybe the first hour of your Friday. And feel free to grab a beer or eat peanuts.
Cool.
So generally it helps, I think, if we start backwards and just kind of talk about like where you are, who you are now and kind of what you're doing and literally what you did this week in a way to understand like what your jobs entail. Mm-hmm. So Dominic and Chris run an architecture firm together called Leung Leung. They are brothers, in case you didn't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what'd you guys work on today?
Let's see. What do we do? I guess the last thing we did, in reverse chronological order, the last thing we did was we had a meeting about a scope matrix for a project.
The fuck is a scope matrix?
You know, that Excel spreadsheet that tells you what you're supposed to do every step of the way.
Do you guys figure it out? You know what you're doing?
Yeah, there's always some gray zones that you have to like talk through. But I think we figured it out.
Can you say what project this is for? Not yet.
This was for a house we're working on in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And yeah, as things go, it's been going on for longer than expected.
The project or just the kind of like scope definition part?
The project.
Got it.
I guess that's one part of being an architect is it takes a long time.
Things gone way longer than you expect.
And it's just like the endurance sport aspect of, you know, how to just get things done. I guess that's the one, Today was just about getting things done. Yeah. Not so creative, just like.
getting things done.
Yeah. Louder?
Louder.
Like, let's see, you guys are 1, 2, and 4. I'll turn them up a little. Yeah. All right.
I don't know, Chris. What?
I had a lot of boring architecture stuff. We had a call with a client about, trying to make sure things didn't go wrong next week. So we're trying to think about proactively trying to avoid disaster, which I think is a little bit of what we do more and more in architecture, is sort of see a few steps down the road, because inevitably things always kind of go haywire. So I think, that's more of what my job is now, is try to, avoid the pitfalls of the inevitable.
I was just rereading. So we did this thing kind of a little bit in the similar like vein as the radio show you're hosting, but we interviewed, Chris and I we've interviewed each other. And one of the interviews we did was trying to understand what our practice was about. And we came up with this metaphor of a Japanese forest garden. And it seemed pretty appropriate. I think today was all about tending the garden. And so the thing about the Japanese forest garden is that it's basically permaculture. So you go and plant different species of like crops in a forest, depending on what the very specific microclimate is and different kind of conditions within the forest. So you find optimal conditions for like beans or radishes. And then the whole idea is like you can't really perceive the whole. There's no like one vantage point where you're like, oh, here's the garden, because the only way you know what's growing or how it's growing is by having this very intimate relationship with the forest. So it's almost like curating plants in the forest and then kind of working through these kind of micro conditions. And we thought like that's kind of what it's like to have an architecture practice. Like there's never really this kind of overarching like image or idea of what the practice is doing. Mm-hmm. It's more of kind of just continually like working through these like conditions, and at some point these different crops are like harvestable. And then at some point you kind of step back and be like, oh, that's planted over there, this is planted here. But you're kind of always like sort of tending these crops in the forest.
Well, that was gorgeous. Well, I was going to say, it also sounds like, because like when you mentioned the, was it Japanese forest garden?
Yeah.
It immediately sounds like such a beautifully romantic thing.
Right.
Which seems very opposite of what you guys just described you did today.
Nature's harsh. Nature is harsh, though.
Yeah. Well, also, I was just going to say, like, you know, you gotta fertilize the ground. You have to, like, yeah, put shit into things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in order to get a beautiful garden to grow, yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
I think certain, well, the stuff. Irony is, like, all we're trying to do is make nice things, you know, but there's so much work that goes into it, you know. But maybe we think a lot of the labor, maybe we're sometimes a little bit too...
Well, this is something I think, especially... How long have you guys been in your practice now?
We're going to be 10 years in 2019.
Okay. So, I mean, you guys are still considered a young practice, but actually, like, you've had some experience what it is to run a business for a little while now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I feel like for any of the kids listening that are, like, romanticized about the architectural profession, mm-hmm, there's a lot of amazing things, but there's also just, like, doing the bullshit. Mm-hmm. And probably not designing, I can imagine, as much as you had sort of idealized it.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you feel about that? Like, are you still happy to be in the architecture profession?
Yeah, I love it. No, I love it. No, it's getting... I think, honestly, it's getting better and better. Like, I feel like it's taken 10 years to really just build, like, a strong foundation and develop enough knowledge and expertise to feel, like, super confident, just kind of getting involved in any type of project. And I think architects in general have a pretty robust sense of self, but I think there's a whole reality to what it means to actually make and do complex projects, and I think it's taken us 10 years to kind of like figure out how to sit in a room with a bunch of other people from other disciplines and like navigate that, and so yeah, I feel like it was just a lot of foundation building for 10 years.
Yeah, like, I mean, one thing is we, our father's an architect, so we grew up around it. And one thing that our father always said is, like, how hard it is to run an architecture business. So I think we always have that kind of in the back of our mind. We took slightly different paths. Like, his path was, you know, he was trained as, like, a computer scientist, and then he became a cabinet maker and a builder. And so he kind of trained himself to be an architect. And you know, we kind of, like, started, like, studying architecture and... you know, learning all these references and like Le Corbusier, mm-hmm, and Louis Kahn. And so we kind of had a different entry point, but I think always had this in the back of our mind, this idea of like, you know, architecture is, one is like super collaborative and, never is not just about kind of like producing a sketch and then the thing gets realized. And, I think that's why I love doing architecture. I get pretty excited, you know, even though things like we talked about, you know, things are not always easy, but I get pretty excited just to come to work and get to collaborate with people and work on things. And I think that's what, to me, is, like, really exciting and not always clear about what architects do, is there's so many things you have to do, mm-hmm, with other people. And I don't know. I think that sometimes you've got to have, like, really big ideas, but how do you explain those ideas to other people so that they get excited about it, too? I think that's what's cool to me about what's architectural.
I mean, obviously, you guys run your office. It's a dumb, dumb thing to point out, but what role do you guys see in your practice? Like, what are you an editor? Are you a director? Mm-hmm. Are you just the dude like keeping the lights on? Well, all of that.
I think it's evolved. Mm-hmm. It evolves as like the what we did when we for year one and two was like we were really just like designers who we're trying to like kind of just at that point we didn't really have a business, right? You're just designing, you have like one or two projects, so like the complexities of like business are like pretty simple, and then you like grow and then you have to like, you know, bring on other people, and then you kind of move from a designer more to like a almost like, yeah, you're working with people, and then that grows and you're like actually take on the role of like a curator, like curating like design ideas or planting seeds and cultivating that with other people. And then I think you step into, and then there's like definitely like management that happens along the way, but then I think ultimately you kind of step into this role of being a leader, because I think once you start working with certain kind of like, you know, civic projects, then there's all these like leadership skills that come up into play that weren't really needed before, because it was more like one-on-one relationships. And then, you know, now it's like, how do you communicate? How do you negotiate? How do you connect with people who outside of your immediate kind of realm? And also, I think how do you communicate narratives that have value for other people in a pretty broad sense? So I feel like, yeah, maybe it's like part of evolving is this idea of like, what are the stories that architecture needs to tell for not only architecture, but for other people? And I think that's when you start to gain value for architecture, is when you can tell a story that is not, that other people can relate to and can kind of see why this building needs to exist outside of one's own kind of desire to create that.
Has your conception, like from, let's say, day one of the 10-year trip so far, has your conception of what your job as an architect was or would be changed? I mean, obviously your job has literally changed, like your roles have evolved. Mm-hmm. But, or maybe another question is actually, has your idea of what an architecture practice, its role is, has that changed mm-hmm. from when you first started? Like what the point of an architecture practice
yeah,
is?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I guess most, I was just thinking about this today actually. Like, and also I just think within the context of our current kind of political environment, I thought part of what architecture does is it in a way it's care. It's like care for people. And I feel like architects at their best have the privilege of creating spaces and places that ultimately are about taking care of people and putting people in environments that enable them to do things that they couldn't have done otherwise in small and large ways. And I think that's been my shift. Like, I think before I was like very much focused on like, in a way, like the architectural idea, like how does this fit within this history of ideas? And then now I think more about how does that history of ideas fit within a kind of, as a way to like create new spaces for people. Mm-hmm. Like it's about people. Like, and I guess like being in school, you don't really like get that. And then when you start putting kind of buildings in the world, you're like, this is a privilege to be able to create spaces for other people.
Mm-hmm. I remember when, I don't know if it was Sana or Sajima was the curator for the Venice mm-hmm. Biennale. Mm-hmm. And like the theme was something like architecture is where people meet or something like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't quite that, but it was like something like that. Yeah. And I remember when I first heard it, I was like, only Japanese architects could get away with a title mm-hmm. that simple and seemingly dumb. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what the fuck is that? And then more and more, I was like, that's the most genius mm-hmm. thing, because weirdly, especially in that world, in the academic world, you kind of forget that. Mm-hmm. You're like, dude, you're designing spaces for people. Don't ever forget that.
Yeah.
It's like the whole reason you're doing anything you're doing.
Yeah.
You're not. It's not about necessarily contributing to the discourse. It's not about pushing theories forward. Like that mm-hmm. is all in service of spending a shit ton of money and a shit ton of resources and a shit ton of hours to create spaces for people.
Yeah.
Do you think that let's say that evolution of what you just said is also being further and further removed from school? Like now you're. Mm. Years out working professionally?
Well, strangely, like, well, because we teach at Columbia, it's, I think it's like being in the world, trying to do these, like, you know, pieces of architecture in the world, the confluence of that and then the timing of just like our country just going through this kind of like moment of chaos and lack of care for like just basic human rights. I think the combination of those two things, but then going back into academia, I realized that's also part of the same process of, in a way, trying to bring the experiences we've had, and like, because we're not like full-time academics, so like what we can offer the students is like a kind of balance of like discourse, but also I think some glimpse into what it means to actually try to like really do things in the world that have some kind of like impact.
I think we always talk about architecture being both fast and slow, and it's like part of this idea of, I think, you know, architecture is great because it's you're connecting so many dots all the time, you know, thinking about both like the city down to the scale of like a chair, and there's like so many things in between, and ultimately like, yeah, architecture being for people, if you put it in that time frame or that kind of like thinking about how people endure, how things get used, I mean, that's that slowness that I think is really important, like the things that you know sit with you or the space that you go back to. I think the more and more that I am like alive, the more and more I think about the things.
I mean,
that
the older you get,
yeah, the older I get, yeah, closer to death, the closer to death I get, the more I just appreciate those spaces, like, you know, even just like the depth of a bench, or like, this sounds very cheesy, but like when things are just comfortable, and you can't actually make things comfortable if everything's abstract to you. And then I think like if you think about it in a broader sense of like what makes a city a place you want to live, like you kind of have to live, you know, in cities or think about who those people are. That's kind of hard stuff to just teach in school, you know.
It was funny. Chris, you went to Berkeley, right?
Yeah.
When you mentioned the bench thing, there's like, did you ever have, for his first name, Professor Whitaker?
No.
He was part of the whole Sea Ranch crew.
Yeah.
And I mean, he must have been in his like 70s, maybe 80s when I had him. And he was like, you know, full white hair, big bushy old man,
yeah.
Eyebrows and stuff. And the only thing he was actually really great, but the only thing I remember specifically from him was he was like, every time you design a stair at the landing, make sure you put a bench. And the reason you put a bench is so the grandfather, when he goes up the stair, can take a rest and he can read a story to his grandchild. And I was like, that's what architecture is? I was like, that's a weird, but weirdly, like you said, like the older I get, the more I maybe need that bench now. Like the more I'm like, oh damn, that's actually really amazing as like silly, yeah. Or not even silly, as kind of like minute as that is. Obviously, you can expand that into all sorts of scales and stuff. But it's true. Like, there's these funny, literal, personable stories that that's how people interact with architecture.
Yeah.
That's how 99% of the people interact with architecture anyway. And without thinking about it as architecture, that's really key. It feels like such a Berkeley.
Yeah.
Like, Sea Ranch era Berkeley.
No, I'm like, that still is sort of, like, ingrained a little bit, you know? Like, I think I probably resisted it when I was there. I never took the Nature of Order class, sort of where
like Christopher Alexander,
yeah, where everyone really talks about, you know, how many, you know, doorknobs or frames within the paneling of the door that you have. But I do think that stuff's pretty interesting to think about. Mm-hmm. Like, actually, we work with Charles Renfro, who's you know, pretty great architect. He works with Dolores Cofidio, and they're doing these kind of pretty insane projects all over the world, like the High Line or like the Shed. But he always tells people, like, to all his employees, like, carry around a tape measure, because if it feels good, you gotta measure it, you gotta understand what those dimensions are. And that, for me, that was kind of always resonated for someone who seems sort of all about sort of the big ideas, that he actually really pays attention to, like, actually how things, you know, the dimension of a bench. And I think the more I get into architecture, the more I care about those little differences. Mm. So yeah, it's like nice to think about, you know, someone like Whitaker has been around for a while. Like, the
I
things
hope
he wants
around,
to.
Actually, I just realized he might not.
Yeah,
it's kind of depressing.
Yeah.
Can you guys talk about, because with the you guys are on the cusp of, I guess, opening up the LGBTQ center in LA. And whether that project or maybe a recent project, can you talk about a moment, like a point in that design where you were able to design or wanted to design that kind of space for a person or for people?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, everything is obviously for people, but
yeah, I guess I always talk about when we were designing the project, we went to visit other facilities, other like LGBTQ schools, and or just kind of like social service projects. And we went to the Harvey Milk School in New York, which was designed by Smith Miller Hawkinson in like, I think it was like the late 80s. And it's a high school, and the high school was essentially for kids who weren't comfortable in their normal schools, that they could go to this school. And so they were walking us through the project, and they said, yeah, like this, we intentionally designed this to not look like a normal high school, to kind of disassociate these kind of experiences of negative experiences of like even trauma that these individuals needed to have a space that was basically like new, like something that didn't have the history of like things they experienced before. And I think I realized at that moment, like what the potential of architecture is, that there is a value to creating spaces or kind of aesthetic experiences that are beyond what is conventional in order to allow people to like reorient themselves to other people, but also to themselves. And it kind of like renewed my faith in like a very concrete way, where you're like, yes, there are like empirical kind of reasons of why we should do architecture that isn't just super conventional, that it's part of how we like self-actualize as individuals and the kind of society as a whole, that architecture actually enables these new possibilities, new ways of like convening or like living together. And so I think in the context of the LGBT campus that we designed in Hollywood, it really is about that. It's about this kind of mixed-use project that combines like different generations of living and supportive services and kids living on the street, a safe space to just be themselves and like stabilize. So there's a kind of like a whole range of modalities that these different individuals come into this space, and the kind of different spaces that are needed to kind of support their sense of self, but also like growth and evolution into just being who they are. And so that was such an amazing project to work on in that sense, that it sort of like really foregrounded like the importance of architecture to create space that didn't exist before.
Are there any like in that project, are there any specific design moments formally or materially or whatever circulation wise that you're like, oh, it's like we did that with the bench exactly with that explicit intent to create?
I guess the biggest part, the most notable design element was that we actually introduced like a program into it that wasn't part of the original program, which was kind of like event space. And the idea was that like, this like campus should have a space of like celebration, as much as it should just kind of serve these kind of supportive services, that there should be this like moment where like LGBT community in the context of this project can kind of like have like events and like have a rooftop where you can have events and you can like just celebrate the community in a way. And so I thought that was like a pretty unique thing to add.
Yeah. I think one of the other elements that we try to put in the project from the very beginning, because there's so many different services and so many different programs and even identities and ways to get in the building, was this idea of creating outdoor space that still is within a sanctuary that still feels very protected, so that you could be in this space, this youth center, and go outside, feel very protected, but still look up to the sky and be in this sort of like garden space. So there's a lot of these sort of little pocket gardens within the space, which I think was always like really important, that there are these spaces for sort of sanctuary where you could kind of gather and just be calm within this like larger kind of complex.
Do you remember, so you guys started the office 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Had you both always wanted to start an office? Like, was that just sort of like, as soon as you got an architect, you're like, one day we're going to have an office?
It was never together. It was never discussed, but it was always assumed, I think.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's an interesting question, because I don't think we thought we were going to start an office. I think we thought, oh, we should, let's work together.
Why? I mean, it's great. Obviously, it works, and it's amazing, but, like, that's, you know, working with family is difficult in itself.
Yeah, in retrospect, we probably should, like, talked about it beforehand, but I think we just, like, kind of grew up, like, you know, around it, and it was sort of this, I don't know, just, there was this, like, we're probably going to do this at some point, and we just had a project to start working on, and I don't know why.
In retrospect, I think it's actually kind of more rare than I appreciate. You know, I've got two sons, you know, and I kind of imagine if they would work together or not. But, I mean, our family is, like, very small. Like, it was our father, who was an architect, and our mother was a school teacher. And, you know, we always have this very small family. We always kind of worked on things together. And, you know, our father built his own, you know, our own house. And so everything was always like, oh, when you just be in a family or spending time together, it means you kind of, like, work on these projects together. So I think maybe that was sort of there's maybe a carryover of that, is just to kind of, like, you know, that's part of, like, being in a family. You kind of, like, work on things together.
Always productive.
Try to stay productive.
Wait, will you tell them about the couples therapy?
Oh, yeah. Ooh. So we go to couples therapy.
I'm not supposed to be talking about that.
Just to clarify, you're talking about you and your brother, right?
Yeah, sorry. This is Dominic and Chris.
Dominic and Chris go to couples therapy.
Every week.
We call it family therapy.
It's couples therapy.
It's couples therapy.
I mean, you probably spend more time with Chris than Dean, I'd imagine.
Yeah. We're basically...
Married.
Married. Chris and I are married.
Married brothers.
Yeah.
Brother wives.
Totally.
Or husbands.
Yeah.
Husbros.
Husbros.
It's good. We go once a week for, like, an hour and a half.
Nice.
We talk about all the things that we're not naturally inclined to talk about, but are probably the most important things, which I think, I don't know, I feel like that's part of, like, you know, in families, there's a lot of, like, or at least in our family, a lot of unspoken things that exist. So I think it's helped us, like, be more direct and communicative, and hold space for each other's experience. Because, like, as growing up as brothers, we're, like, you know, 17 months difference, there's, like, a lot of competition. And that kind of competition can get pretty tense. So it's like either one person's right and the other person's wrong. And I think actually we had to give a lecture, and we were both going to give the lecture, and we were having these, like, long conversations about, like, who puts the voice of the office, like, how do we kind of come to some sort of, like, agreement on, like, what the narrative is of what we do. And then we realized, actually, we're, like, two different people. There's actually three voices here. There's, like, Chris, me, and then there's the voice of the office. And then that realization was, like, yeah, we can, you know, we can make space for all these different stories, and they can coexist. And actually having a differentiation of these voices makes the whole thing, like, more rich, rather than trying to, like, always have a consensus or agreement. And I think that was, like, a huge thing. It's like, oh, we're just, like, we're different people. I mean, we work together and we have this office, but we have two different voices, and we orient ourselves to the work in different ways, and actually acknowledging that difference makes it more robust.
Which point in that 10-year growth did you come to that realization?
Like 2 years ago?
Two, three years ago.
So it's, like, relatively a new understanding of the office.
Yeah.
Was it like a sea change in terms of how you looked at the office once you, like, decided that was...
I think it just, like, loosened things up. Because you're like, it's just like, you be you, I'll be me. And then then the office is, like, some weird combination of that. And but not only us, the other staff, too. I think that was a huge moment, too. It's like, it's not just our voice. It's, like, also the people we work with and collaborate with. It's their voice, too. And making space for that, I think, was a huge deal.
Yeah, I think having that awareness of holding space for others, you know, I think when you jump into a practice, you kind of have this sense we're always got to be aligned. But the more you get into it, you're like, actually, this is how I feel about something. Other people are going to feel differently about it, and that's okay. You got to kind of like hear it out. And I think that's like, I mean, we have a really amazing team that works with us. And in our best moments, or in my best moments, I'm really aware and so appreciative of like these amazing people that I get to work with and giving them space to do things and see things differently than I do. That's when everything's like, you know, the best. And I like, you know, everyone who works with us, I feel very
shout
grateful.
Shout out
office.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we have a great crew.
What was the first, like when you guys started, what prompted the start of the office? Was it just like, we're starting an office now, or was there a project that came in?
We had a project. We were working with Philip Lim, fashion designer at the time. And they wanted to do another project. And it was, actually had like another office at the time. And like,
you had another office. Oh, Para.
Yeah, Para. Yeah. And
wait, that's what it was called? I don't even think I know that.
It was called Para Project, which still exists. John Lott still runs Para Project. So it was more of like a jam band. I call it a jam band because we were all like kind of working at other places and you know how that goes. And then I think there was like this transition of like, oh, what does it mean to actually have a practice? What does it mean to have a business? And that kind of level of commitment is a totally different thing. And so there was like a moment where it was like, all right, like, how does this move forward? And then I think at that point it was like this brother dynamic was like, this is something that is going to last. And this is something that we can invest in and know that we're going to fight the fights and like it's going to last no matter what. And so I think that was like the transition. But it was all like under the context of having this one project that we could like, you know, start working on.
Was it both of you guys were pair with John and Pair Buddy? No,
yeah,
just Don.
Just me, yeah.
Where were you guys, working when you like made that switch to not only Leung, but actually maybe started working through Pair? Were you guys, still working at other offices?
I was like full-time working as Pair Project. And Chris was at Shop.
I was at Shop Architects.
Yeah.
How long were you at Shop?
Probably like, I like think about like 5 years. I was interning there for 2 summers, and then I worked there 3 years, like full time. Those are like my, probably like formative years in that office.
And then did you make a clean break to join Dom as Leung?
It was like the pinnacle of the recession. It was like everyone's looking for work.
Yeah.
So I'm either going to stress out working for somebody else or take the plunge and stress out, you know, working on my own.
Well.
And basically you can't fail at that point because, you know, no one had any work. But we were very fortunate to have this, you know, collaboration with Philip Lim, and that was an amazing, you know, opportunity at the time. We just kind of like, you just kind of jump into the abyss and you don't really realize you're in an abyss. Or you actually don't realize you're in an abyss, but you also don't realize what you have that is also something to work on, which was like super fortunate. We had a great project out of the gate, and then every moment from there on was like, you know, how do you find the right opportunities? Mm-hmm. How do you find the right things to work on? But part of like, you know, if you thought about it too much, I don't know if you would do it the same way. You know, part of it's kind of like just naively jumping.
How do you relate to that question?
The like, what was the question?
I forgot what the question. How you start and like, you kind of have a similar kind of trajectory in a way.
I mean, I always feel like that's really an interesting moment because like even the mechanics of how you met that first project, whatever it's a client or whatever, or like what we did was same thing recession. It was kind of like, well, fuck it. Might as well pick a name. We have an office now kind of thing. Like, I registered a website, picked a name, and we had an office. I don't think I even applied for the business entity for, like, a year or something like that because I didn't know that was a thing you had to do. and then was just doing competitions, I think, just to try to figure out what it was like to work on your own. Mm-hmm. And then Plus Pool was actually the first project. And at that time, I wasn't even thought it was like a project, but it was the first, like, thing that had any kind of, like, our office had any kind of identity with. Mm-hmm. And then weirdly, I think the first paying project was actually, I remember the timeline, but I think it was the storefront Worms for Idea City, or what it was called, something else, but Street Fest or something like that.
Mm-hmm. How does it feel to have a project that's like as old as your office? Like if that project's like evolved, that project's evolved, but then your practice evolved. Yeah. Like how does
it? Well, what's weird is the architecture part of the project hasn't evolved that much.
Yeah.
I mean, it's obviously like gotten more refined, but the basic premise of the architecture hasn't really changed, which I take great pride in. Like the original idea actually had a ton of legs, which we didn't realize at the time, and just kept running. The world around it, the growth of the organization is completely different than I ever anticipated, and we're involved in things that I never thought I'd be involved in and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But
like what? Wait, I'm curious.
So for example, just out of practicality, we're like, all right, we have to fundraise for this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you do that? Because it was a total initiative. So we ran two Kickstarters and raised enough money to do a bunch of testing on the filtration idea. For people who don't know, it's a floating pool project. And it filters river water like a big strainer, basically. So we kickstarted money to do that. And then at some point, we were trying to decide how to, again, keep raising money for it. So we started a 501c3. Mm. So we built a board. We have an incredible board now. We have a gala, which, shout out to Pluspool, we have a gala November 14th, pluspool.org/gala.
Sweet.
please join us. And but in terms of things we're doing, besides, I think, like, weirdly having conversations with governmental officials, mayor's office, state officials, all these organizations around the country and world. Jeff is one of the founders, is leading a swim program for NYCHA children, and it's been the third or fourth year now.
Mm.
And it's like 20 kids a class for about 4 weeks, 8 to 12. Again, it's because I think we had a chance to do it. We knew a bunch of competitive swimmers, and we knew a bunch of pools, and we're like, fuck it, that seems like an easy connection to make. But never at all in our wildest dreams where we're like, we're going to build a pool project and in the meantime teach kids how to swim. Hmm. So those kind of things which are never planned, but really obviously there's a lot of pride in doing that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Does that change your perception of what architecture can and should do?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't think we'd be doing this radio project without the pool project.
Right.
And just in terms of how we thought about what we could do as architects or designers.
Mm-hmm.
This is such a good idea, by the way.
What is?
The radio.
Oh, thanks. It is really fun.
Yeah.
I have no idea, like, what'll happen. It's one of those things where it's like, I know why we wanted to do it. I have no idea what the end result will be or how to value it or anything, but it is really fun.
Mm-hmm.
Just to, like, literally even just, like, these kind of moments where you're just sitting, like, over beers and peanuts and you're able to, like, talk about stuff is, like, the funnest thing.
Yeah.
It's really incredible.
No, I mean, I think it just the whole setup of like being on a storefront and really putting it in the neighborhood and creating some kind of portal that connects, you know, what you do as an architect and the way you think about and the conversations you have with like a different audience and very specifically like the people in the immediate neighborhood and the kids in the immediate neighborhood is like it's pretty great.
I mean, I was going to ask like what you were saying in terms of your family of four people, you've always understood the family as something that like does stuff together, builds things together physically or, you know, psychologically or whatever. Obviously it seems like you guys are very tight knit.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's kind of that ideal conception in a lot of ways of a family. And obviously being able to rely on your brother as I can imagine the person you trust probably the most of a lot of people and being able to start a business with them and stuff. It seems like there must be some tie-in there with looking at architecture as, like it sounds very familial when you talk about the role of what you're trying to do.
Mm.
Like, I mean, it's a little corny, but the kind of larger family of like, let's provide things for people.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's about caring for people and actually extending that idea of putting something out there for other people in a caring way. Which is not always like, I mean, I think that is a role of architects, but it's not every architect's primary response to what they do.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, no, it's true. Just to use that language relative to architecture is like not that like cool, or like not, you know, like
not super hip.
Yeah.
It's not like discursive.
Yeah.
I think it's, yeah.
But it's, I mean, also, I think it is. In other, in, I mean, and I think, well, sorry, just to like diverge, but I think being exposed to art and artists and some of the things that Dina does with her organization has, I think, opened up a different conversation about what architecture can do and should do. But I think back to the question, like, I just realized, I was like, yeah, our dad designed and built our house. He built architecture for our family, mm-hmm. and we built that collectively, and we worked on that house. Every,
did you actually, like,
every
physically
summer,
work on
yeah,
the house?
Yeah, we did, like, just hardcore manual labor every summer. The house is, like, not even done yet.
Employ your,
like,
children.
Probably almost, like, yeah, exactly. I mean, talk about, like, your question about, like, what, how did we earn our first buck? It was literally, like, working like working on our house for our dad, and he was, like, generous enough to actually, like,
here's $1.
Yeah, pay us hourly for it. So it was, like, just, like, very, like, extensive, like, chores, basically, of, like, paint the whole, like, side of the house, yeah, in, like, two
weeks.
It
was very Karate Kid style. Like, sand the wall. Sand and spackle.
Just sand and spackle for, like, 8 hours in the middle of summer.
Yeah. Did you guys ever do any work with your dad?
Oh, yeah.
We've done.
Is that fun or terrible or both? Or
kind of both. I mean, it's interesting. I don't know. It's evolved. Like, earlier on, we did a lot more work with him. Huh. Like, the store I did for Philip Lim in Los Angeles, he was, like, the main collaborator.
Okay.
He was, like, the executive architect. Huh. And we did the drawing set together, which is pretty cool in retrospect. I mean, at the moment, there's, like, a lot of, like, no, I mean, it doesn't matter who you're working with. There's, you know, there's always, like, highs and lows.
Especially with the kind of, like, leave me alone, Dad, like that.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, I know what I'm doing. He's like, no, you don't really know. But, you, yeah, anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, it's well, there's a lot of, like, yeah, especially early on, a lot of phone calls to, like, you know, how would you handle the situation? Mm-hmm. How would you do this? How would you draw that? But I think in architecture, you're always, like, figuring out stuff. You're always doing stuff you just don't, no one knows how to do. You kind of, when you kind of, like, know how to do it, like, you kind of just want to get, you feel like, I feel like I'm always getting to the point where, like, I just wish I knew how to do this, you know, and just do it. But then you're like, then you get that point, you're like, this is super boring. Like, you kind of, you're kind of always trying to find that thing that you're like, well, how do we do this?
Yeah.
Yeah, and early on, like, there's so many questions, whether it's, like, how do you draw this? How do you build this? And he's actually very experienced and is always like, well, this is what could go wrong, you know? So he's always kind of in your back of your mind of, like, thinking about all those things, you know? So you're sort of, like, scenario planning constantly, and he's always been, like, a good sounding board.
Tell us everything that could go wrong.
Such an Asian dad.
Yeah, like, no sons of mine are going to fuck this up. Yeah. So I was just going to ask, your dad is Chinese,
a little Hawaiian.
Okay.
Yeah.
And your mom is American, white American?
Yeah, she's German-Irish from St. Louis.
Okay. Yeah. Did you ever talk to your dad about what it was like being a entrepreneurial architect of Asian descent?
Yeah, he's got a pretty unique situation. I think when I was in college, I was taking this class on multiculturalism, and one of the assignments was to, like, interview one of your parents. And so I remember interviewing him.
Was it in California?
It was in California. And so they live in, like, Napa Valley, which is, like, predominantly, I would say, Latino, Latina, and white, I guess. And he's one of the maybe, like, five Asian people who have lived in that town in the last, like, 30 years.
He was basically the only, he and one other guy were, like, two Asian guys in town.
Huh. Yeah. And I think he doesn't really, like, talk about it in those terms, just until recently, actually, when we were just visiting him, and he's like, yeah, you know, like, I'm the only Asian guy in town. Like, you know, there's been moments where, like, that's definitely affected how he's, like, received in that particular community. But in general, like, his personality is just, like, kind of just doesn't factor that into the way he does things. But I don't know. There's some pretty conservative aspects of, like, Northern California that I'm sure he's, like, bumped up against. But So in a way, he's like kind of, it's kind of weird. He's
I wonder if anything has to do with he grew up in Hawaii, which of all the places, if you ever talk to someone from Hawaii, is Asian. You're like, there's really no glass ceiling if you're like Asian in Hawaii, because everyone in government, everyone, the mayor, the centers, like everyone's Asian. It sort of becomes second nature.
What's also, I guess, understood is like, what is Hawaiian is Asian Hawaiian, whereas where like what is American is white American. Do you know when he moved from or into Napa? Was it from Hawaii to Napa?
No. So he went to school at Santa Clara for undergrad, and then he went to MIT in like the late 60s to actually study systems design, which was at the time sort of, I guess, relatively new like field of research that corresponded with like artificial intelligence. So he was like MIT doing all this weird like work that eventually, I mean, there was some, he basically had these like ideological like conundrum, because all that work was more or less like feeding into like weapons design. So it was like late 60s, counterculture shit was going on. It was pretty crazy. And then he had this moment where he wanted to be an architect, or decided he wanted to be an architect. And he basically left MIT and moved back to Northern California. And some of his classmates had moved from Santa Clara up into Napa Valley. So he kind of just like ended up there. And then he kind of like started from scratch. He's just like, I'm just going to like build cabinets and like build, just like build stuff. And then he kind of just evolved from being like a cabinet maker to a builder into becoming an architect. So he's totally like self-taught relative to architecture. But he's like kind of like fundamentally like an engineer in terms of how he approaches like design problems, which is very different, I think, than the way like we were trained. Like, it's like waterproofing detail. It's like, oh, like, how do I make sure this detail just like looks great? And then he's just like, that is going to leak. Like, you know, like thinking through the basically the engineering of problems maybe before the aesthetic. Like,
yeah, but it'll photograph really well.
Yeah, I'm like, I just got to get that photo for Instagram.
You'll get it, Dad. we had a actually a panel or whatever, a guest group of three Asian women, and one of them was, we've had a number now, but half Asian, half white. And so, and she actually split her time between Hong Kong and here. And it was interesting that when she was in Hong Kong, she wasn't Chinese enough. She was seen as a white person. When she was here, she was definitely seen as an Asian person, wasn't seen as like American in that sense. And for you guys, I was curious, like, did you ever encounter that where you were for yourselves trying to figure out, am I Asian, am I white American, or was it actually not really a debate? Or wasn't there was a, you were both equally easily?
I mean, I think for me, I guess it wasn't really a conscious thing, but in retrospect, like realizing your dad is the only Asian guy in town, even though it's not a big deal, it's a kind of, it kind of, it's something you kind of think about, like it just, but it's very like just in the background, because didn't feel like I grew up with any like overt racism, and we're like half Asian, so we kind of, we don't look explicitly Asian or not, so it never was like a big thing. And then I think when I went to college and I was in Berkeley and surrounded by all these people who grew up in Southern California who were like Taiwanese first generation immigrants or Korean first generation immigrants, and you know, their parents were like super Asian, and it was sort of like, whoa, this is what it's like to be Asian, you know? And like, I've always, you know, so that was like, so this mind opening thing. But I think like in retrospect, I think we always, well, I always felt like we're a little bit different because mom and dad look so different. Mom's got like red hair. She's very fair skinned and like red hair. Dad's like salt and pepper Asian guy. So your parents don't look like sort of the perfect little pair. And that, you know, that's always kind of makes you think, oh, this is like a little bit different, but everything's cool. And then I think, you know, I think that, that for me, that was always like a, just a background of like, you know, you don't look exactly like everybody else. And I think going to college, kind of realizing when now everything's about identity and everyone's sort of identity is like very much more apparent. That's when I started to be more conscious of that kind of stuff.
Did you find architecture in school anyway when you were there at Berkeley to be I'm not sure how to ask this. Like, I'll kind of back up. One of the themes, I guess, that I've been seeing with a lot of guests is that because everybody's in a creative industry of some sort, that the creative world, like art world, chef world, music world, seems to be much more open to different ethnicities, different kind of sexual orientations, different sort of like gender identifications, for whatever reason. Like, I'm sure there's good reasons for that. And a lot of people, I think, identified as a community with not so much people that look like them at first, but that kind of shared interest. Hmm. And then from that, realized that actually their appearance or ethnicity was actually sort of secondary to the fact that they all liked the same music or like the same kind of art or whatever it is. Hmm. So I guess the question was like, did you see an architecture when you were at Berkeley, especially, or you were at San Luis Obispo?
Yeah.
Did that seem like an inclusive community in terms of it didn't matter?
Mm-hmm. I mean,
what
actually
race or background you were coming from?
Yeah. I think that's a good point. I mean, actually, Dean and I have talked about this, like, what role does, like, in relationship to art, like, what role does art play in terms of, in a way, creating the space that you're talking about for, like, difference to exist, mm-hmm. and for people to encounter difference. Mm-hmm. I think that's true. I mean, I think...
And, like, you have a community of difference, basically.
Yeah. And I think there's something... I mean, like, at Cal Poly, the architecture school was, like, the school with all the weirdos. Because the rest of the campus is definitely, like, it's, like, pretty conservative, you know. There's, like, a very religious aspect of it. And so the architecture school is, like, where anyone who had, like, dyed hair, like, you know, it's, like, that's where they all were. Like, everyone was, like, dressing not in, like, khakis and, like, a polo shirt. Right. So in a way, yeah, I think architecture school is way more open.
I do feel like any of, like, it's, especially when you see it in school, like, all of the creative clubs or majors, it's you're fit in more by being different than by wearing the khaki polo. Yeah. Like, you look right. super weird
it's
if you're wearing.
It's not about total assimilation.
Yeah,
it's
and you actually, like, stand out completely if you seem milk toasty or middle of the road. Hmm. Versus, I can imagine other majors. You could be like, let's say, a business major or something like that, mm-hmm. Or a medical degree. Like, you, if you're sort of different, you're clearly different mm-hmm. from the status quo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I'm not sure where I'm going with this.
I think it's. I mean, I don't know if it was at the time. I mean, I agree with you. Like, you know, architecture is a kind of place where, sort of like, the arena of ideas, and you know, it's good to have a different perspective, you know, so the more specific your perspective, the more kind of useful it might be, maybe. And I would definitely agree, like, at architecture school at Berkeley, it was more like the art school, kind of, you know, not quite, but it was a little bit more, it was inherently diverse. Berkeley's pretty diverse in general. But, you know, like, thinking about, you know, what, I mean, also maybe, they were always, like, for me, like, Asian professors. I always had Asian professors, you know? So it was not a thing of, like, oh, this mm-hmm. isn't something you can't mm-hmm. be, right, you know? Because my biggest kind of professors, like, you know, like, a lot of them were Asian. There weren't that many black professors mm-hmm. in architecture. You know, it wasn't totally diverse, but I think, you know, there was one thing. It's like I had these kind of, if you had like Ravi right, yeah, Chai yeah. or Renee awesome. Chow, you know, there were always kind of like Asian professors that, you know, made you think, oh, this is totally normal.
And I guess just growing, I mean, I can imagine like growing up with your dad being an entrepreneurial architect, mm-hmm. like there's someone in your household that looks like you,
yeah.
obviously.
Yeah.
And subconsciously or not, I can imagine that must have been giving you guys confidence, or did it? Do you reflect on that giving you confidence to start your own thing at some point, or be like, oh,
yeah,
we can do
so.
That? Like, we can
yeah,
that.
I mean, basically, we did what he did, but in a yeah. different city at a different time. It was like, let's just start building stuff, which is essentially what he did, mm-hmm. and then like the business kind of evolved out of that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I think that is one power of family is like the familiarity of like what the family. Does already, like, you can't just like inherit that like mm. capacity. And then I think in a way he created a pretty strong foundation for us in terms of like thinking about things in certain ways. And I think also just like the relentless tenacity that is kind of required to like do architecture. It's like he just works all the time.
Is he still practicing?
Yeah, and then he goes to bed at like 2 a.m. he basically
like wakes up at 4 and works more.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's like he's getting more, because you know when you get older, you sleep less. He's really like doubling down on that and just like try to maximize his like utilization rate, which I think he would love if like somehow we could give him like some metric to track his own utilization rate. He'd just be like so stoked.
Has he ever told you what he would do if he's not an architect? Has he ever shared that?
No.
What would you do, Don, if you weren't an architect?
Like if I could be anything that I wanted to be?
Yeah.
So I wanted to be a pro surfer when I was a kid, but I was like, no, it wasn't even like an option. I was nowhere near good enough.
Mm-hmm.
That still seems like a pretty dream ideal job. If I could like immediately snap my fingers and suddenly be incredibly good at surfing, I feel like that'd be a pretty
good job. We should just start our own, surf company and sponsor ourselves.
It'd be amazing if you had like very average surfing.
And I was going to say, we should
surfing for really average.
We should sponsor surfers. People who...
Like are not.
We could start a surf school. Wait, Rockaway.
Only dreamed about being really good at surfing.
Is there a Rafa brand for surfing?
What's Rafa?
It's a cycling brand, but it's for
like just general people.
Just mediocre people.
But they, but the branding of it is the ethos of perseverance and struggle. So it's like really cool.
for really
average weekend warriors. Who, really like to dig in, and they've created a whole brand aesthetic around it that is so appealing that
and it works.
You should totally do that.
That'd be amazing. I like this mediocre surf sponsored
mediocre excellence.
Yeah. Well, first I was gonna say that's basically what Saturdays is.
Yeah, you're right. That is it. Yeah,
weekend warrior.
I do think you could brand it in a way that's clearly. Like laughing at just being mediocre.
Oh my god, it can be called so-so surfer.
So-so surfer. I'm okay. We'll make wetsuits.
Take a little bit of Kook Slams.
Yeah.
Mash it up with Rafa or Saturdays, and maybe.
But wetsuits could have a little more room around the gut.
Oh my god, it'd be so good.
But you also have to really do events where people can do things together, so
I
was just thinking, it's not you're not off on your own. You're oh, you suck.
There's triple the amount of medical professionals on site just in case.
Yeah, totally.
It's definitely my age group.
Yeah.
Well, there's a friend of ours down in Virginia Beach runs a surf contest that's basically a costume contest.
Oh, that's cool.
So it's kind of based on how well you surf in your costume, but it's not at all a tricks thing. It's just
how extravagant are these costumes?
Pretty extravagant, and the more extravagant, the better, obviously.
Yeah.
But that seems like something where it's not about your skill level of surfing.
No.
It's about style. It's so a dumb costume.
It's kind of about commitment.
Yeah, totally commitment.
Yeah. Dong, how did you make your first dollar? I'm curious.
As a architect, I don't remember if it was Plus Pools Kickstarter thing first or if it was winning that Street Fest competition. I think it was... Oh, no, I take that back. It was... we placed second in a competition. It's very mundane. We placed second in a competition for a museum in Slovenia. And Juan and I did. And so the looking back now was the godsend because we'd have no fucking clue what to do if we actually won. And I don't think the project ever happened. It just got stuck in stuff. But the second place prize was actually a decent chunk of money. And so we took the money and we're we need to do a study trip. So went to, we visited Vals and we did a road trip down through the south of France and stuff. And then we took the other chunk of money and hired PlayLab to build a website for Plus Pool. And then that, we were I don't know how much a website costs, but you have $2,000. Can you guys do a website for $2,000? And of course, they were just starting off. They're like, "Yeah, totally, that's great." Yeah. And of course, they ended up doing a billion times more than we asked, and are an incredible, necessary part of the project, obviously, but kind of help run the basically run the project now. But I think it was just that competition. I think it was that.
Mm. What about before you were an architect?
My jobs.
Very, very first dollar in life.
It was either, I don't remember the timing, it was either working at an ice cream shop or it was picking up trash at the local, I think it was picking up trash at the local fair. So you would go around in a tuxedo t-shirt to class it up, and you'd be in a pair, and it was like the local, or not local, it was like the county fair, so it was like a big full-on, even though it was the middle of San Diego, and then actually like a beach community, it was like, you know, pig wrangling, like corn dog, like full-on country fair style, and you were assigned a section, and you just go around like the, one of those like claspy things with the arm on the end and just pick up trash. But it was actually really rad because as long as your area was clean, my friend and I would sneak off and play poker for like an hour and then come back and like clean up again, like sneak off and play poker.
I think that thing is literally called a trash picker-upper.
Is it a trash picker-upper?
I think so.
Yeah, it's
great.
That's
the full name.
I think that's
trademark.
Literally the name.
I mean, I don't know what else you'd use it for.
You could pick up a lot of stuff. It's usually called a picker-upper.
Claw arm.
Yeah, that was cool. There was a hypnotist show in the area we were in. So we'd always like do a round and like watch the hypnotist. That's pretty much the highlight of my summer.
Wow. Do you know what was your first dollar?
In work or in life?
Let's go life.
Life work.
Honestly, I used to steal my cousin's shit and then sell it back to them. Which worked.
That worked?
That is cutthroat.
Wait, to other cousins?
Yeah, but like my older ones. The ones that like
you wouldn't steal and sell it back to the same cousin?
No, to the same.
Oh, wow.
Like, what was the turnaround? Would you hold it for a little while?
Yeah. Create like that until, demand? Until they got like
how
stressed.
Why did they let you do that?
I think they thought at the time that it was adorable.
Wait, was that more like a ransom thing or like
kind
a...
of. Sort of. It would be like, I know, like we all spent
how old
the
were
summers...
You?
I don't know, probably 7 or 8. And we'd all spend these summers together, and it just...
That's a pretty good hustle.
Yeah.
My family still teases me about this, because now I'm in arts philanthropy, and it feels like sort of the same thing.
Like that does seem like a finance move.
Yeah, like I remember stealing like when cell phones first started. Like I stole my cousin's cell phone.
That sounds like a good...
I was like freaking out looking for it, and then I like sold it back.
You're like, $20.
Yeah. That'd be like a capital campaign, kind of fundraising campaign.
You steal things from... potential donors and then
give them
sell
notice.
It back to them.
Yeah.
Make
them feel
good
this time
about
I'm
it.
Giving it to somebody different, but yeah.
But the key is making them feel like they want to pay you for what was rightfully theirs, maybe to begin with.
Yeah, they just have to be really stressed out about it.
Yeah. Build that anxiety in.
Desperation.
Yeah, totally.
I don't know if you guys have any more questions for each other, but this is kind of. Well, one, I have to pee, so I was going to say we maybe should wrap it up.
Me too.
You can go
I've
first.
I've been sitting here so quiet.
Let me wrap up. And
no, you should go first. You were the host.
No, I feel
we're like. We're gonna just have our own show where you go to the bathroom.
That'd be cool, too.
Should we just talk about dongle eyes in the
bathroom? Yeah, I can probably hear you. But yeah, please do. Especially like, if it's mic'd.
Dong.
All right, well, I'm going to go to the bathroom.
All right.
So thanks for coming on the show.